Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2021 James Irvine Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today, we're live in the studio with experts who will answer your questions about coronavirus. Joining us by phone is Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Duan Utek, and UC Merced Economics Professor, Ketki Sheth. Thank you both so much for joining us for today here live on the radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely. So, Professor Sheth, I'd like to start with you. We got some questions in from our listeners, one of whom is Jason Collins in Fresno, and he's worried in the short term about finding household necessities like sanitary supplies and paper goods. His question to you is, how much of the supply chain for paper goods is dependent on imports?
You know, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of concerns of supply shortages in general. And the main concern comes not from a disruption of supply chains per se, but from individuals who are concerned of shortages that are then creating shortages themselves through hoarding types of behavior. For example, and you know, it's perhaps too early to tell, but Chinese exports were still at 83% of what they were in the same period last year in January and February, when China was experiencing the height of the virus themselves. There also seems to be a lot of efforts by governments to protect the trade of goods in general. And so it seems like we might see slight disruptions in supply, partly driven by unadvised behavior by individuals who are making really large purchases, but that hopefully this won't be an overall issue. And so on that note, we can really try to encourage people to stock up a little, maybe about 15 to 30 days worth of supplies, but that purchasing more is exacerbating these types of supply concerns.
So that hoarding mentality is something, Duan, I'd like to talk to you about or ask you about. You know, people are, of course, stockpiling toilet paper and other supplies, even though there is, you know, as we've just heard, no indication that these will be unavailable in the future. From a behavioral perspective, why do we do this? And are there ways of controlling these hoarding responses? Duan, are you there?
My apologies, I was on mute.
Oh,
it's really normal when we have heightened anxiety or we're worried to panicking to try and control what we can. And when you see other people's behavior, oftentimes that heightens your own anxiety, and so people follow the crowd and everyone starts doing it. I think as time passes and we see that shelves are being restocked and stores are remaining open, we should see these actions settle down. You know, what we encourage people to do when they're feeling anxiety is to focus on the facts. Facts help counter anxiety. And as we hear that supplies are not expected to not be available of things like toilet paper, that people can begin to find ways to calm their nerves. It's also important to think of others' needs at times like this and extra supplies. You could take those and help someone less fortunate.
That's great advice. You know, while we're talking about reaching out to other people, what are some ways to, actually, this was a question that we got from another listener, Rebecca from Sanger. She asked what friends and family can do for people who live alone. How can we help elderly people who already suffer from loneliness and isolation?
Yeah, social isolation can be really hard for anyone's mental health. And when we're all essentially being asked to socially isolate, that's something we want to really focus on. But you can connect to people without breaking the rules, if you will. And so reaching out regularly by phone, contacting your neighbors or people who you know are vulnerable in the community, checking on them, seeing if you can help them. We do know it's important, and we need to remind older people how important it is for their health to stay home right now. I've heard lots of stories of people who are in what we would consider high-risk categories who don't believe that. Don't think that that's an issue. And so reminding them that it's important and offering them assistance to get the supplies that they need, checking in on them regularly are all things that we can do.
Great. So Professor Sheth, I would like to come back to you and talk a little bit about the impact that COVID-19 is having on our national economy. The White House has proposed a $1 trillion economic package that could provide direct payments to taxpayers and loans to keep businesses afloat. How effective do you think that approach will be?
You know, I think that the direct payments to taxpayers and businesses is a critical piece to the effectiveness of any economic package. You know, right now, the need for social distancing is definitely going to have an effect of reducing demand, and that cannot and really should not be avoided so we can effectively address the public health crisis. But ideally, after the public health authorities have advised us to go back to work, we want that workers are able to go back to their jobs, that factories start producing again, and businesses go on as before. And so we want to keep viable, productive businesses afloat so that they can be, you know, productive contributors to the economy after the public health crisis is abated. What would be most damaging is if we not only lose the output from these businesses during the crisis, but if we lose all their future output and contributions to the economy because they weren't able to stave off bankruptcy during this period. In addition, when firms and businesses are faced with reduced demand, there's this natural temptation of wanting to cut costs, you know, such as shedding workers, which then has this cascading effect of increasing unemployment, which we also want to prevent. And, you know, the same is true for individuals. We want to make sure they're protected during a time where they may not be able to be productive, and that's completely out of their control. And with individuals, there's an additional concern. We really want to make sure that individuals don't have to make this tough decision between going to work and risk spreading the virus even further, right? Because they have to pay their rent or pay for food. And we know that when people are making decisions of whether to go to work or follow the guidance of isolation, they have a really hard time accounting for the fact that their decision to go to work poses a risk to others by facilitating the spread of the disease. And so part of making those direct payments to taxpayers is to really make it as easy as possible to make people, you know, have an easy time making the right decision to stay at home. And the best way to do that is make sure they have enough resources to be able to take care of food and basic supplies and so on.
Right. But will the direct payments that have been proposed, do you think that will be enough? Or is this just the first in a wave of potential packages to help the economy manage this crisis?
I think it's really uncertain of how that future will look like with the pandemic. The quicker we are able to abate it, the faster the economic recovery can happen. I agree that we really want to make sure that the amounts that we're providing is enough to keep those businesses afloat. But I do think the faster we can do it, and the more direct those payments can be to businesses and individuals, the better we're going to be able to contain that public health crisis and reduce the economic impact.
So, Dwan, I want to come back to you and talk more about managing anxiety and managing our mental health as we move through these wild times. What are some practical ways of finding normalcy? I mean, none of this is normal, but are there practices that you recommend to help calm us down?
We really recommend that people focus on what you can control and practice good self-care each and every day. So that means getting enough sleep, eating right, and exercising, certainly following the guidelines we've received from public health on social distancing and hand washing, but develop a routine that incorporates a lot of healthy activities. It's important to take a break from the news and social media if you're finding that that increases your stress, and reminding yourself that the services you need will remain available, even with this stay at home or self-quarantine orders that are coming out. Grocery stores stay open. Restaurants have takeout. Medical care is available. It's also important to remind ourselves that there There are many other resources in the community that exist. We have our food banks open. We have schools delivering meals. There are a lot of very dedicated people working on ways to provide help, and people should not be afraid to ask for that help.
So how can people access mental health professionals? I mean, when we're advised not to leave the house, particularly for people who are low income and say, can't afford online therapy?
Well, it's kind of interesting as we've had to address, even within our own workforce, following the guidelines. And so we've shifted to primarily phone therapy now. And so I have a lot of staff who are at their own homes, and they are following through on scheduled appointments with the people that we serve. The county does have an access line where we can offer telephone therapy for anyone low income or Medi-Cal. Our access line number is 1-800-654-3937. We have also started what we're calling a warm line, where we have staffed it to address emotional distress for anyone who calls in. And if you utilize the county's, I believe it's 559-600-INFO, they can transfer you to that line. We're working on getting a dedicated line for that. But there's a lot of other providers through your normal health insurance who are doing the exact same thing that we do. We still do offer in-person services for individuals who are in crisis. So we're trying to maintain the services that we need, just doing it in a little different ways.
Great. Now, we have one more guest that has been able to join us. Dr. Sidhu, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So,
hi.
Hi. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So my name is Manasi Sidhu. I am an ER physician at UCSF Fresno.
I'll throw the next question to you. This is another listener question that we received this week. This is from Joel Soto. We know that COVID-19 is a virus. What Joel wants to know is it also a flu, or is it different from the flu? And if so, how does it differ from the flu?
COVID-19 is a coronavirus. Coronaviruses as a whole cause respiratory illnesses that range from the common cold to potentially deadly illnesses such as SARS, which was first identified in China in 2002, and MERS, that was identified first in Saudi Arabia in 2012. Now, the flu is caused by influenza A and B, both of which are in a different family of viruses. That being said, the symptoms between the flu and COVID-19 are pretty similar, such as fever, cough, fatigue, shortness of breath, and sore throat.
So this is a somewhat morbid question, but when people die from influenza, generally they die of pneumonia. Is that also true of COVID-19?
In some people, the flu causes complications, including pneumonia, as you mentioned. So far in this particular flu season, about less than 1% of people in the U.S. have developed symptoms severe enough to be hospitalized. And the overall hospitalization rate in the U.S. this season for the flu is 61 per 100,000 people. With COVID-19, doctors are still trying to understand the full picture of the disease, symptoms, and severity. So with time, we'll have a better idea of the disease trajectory.
I'm going to come back to you in just a minute with some more questions about the medical side of dealing with the COVID-19 crisis, but I want to move back over to some of the economic implications that we're seeing. Professor Sheth, let's talk about school closures. Obviously, they are shaping a lot of families' lives, but the question we have is what impact might this have on school budgets and education funding?
So far, it doesn't seem like physical school closures are going to affect educational funding. Part of the executive order by Governor Newsom on March 4th was to guarantee that schools will continue to get state funding even with physical closures. And most of the funding for K-12 education in California comes from the state. So, for example, in 2018, over 50% of funding towards California public schools was all state funding. Local property taxes account for about another quarter, which is also unlikely to be affected in the short run due to school closures. And only 9% of funding comes from the federal government. Right now, there is a lack of clarity on exactly what will happen with federal funding, but the general expectation is that federal funding will also be unaffected by physical school closures. we'll have to wait and see what legislation is passed to know exactly what that will look like. But in general, there seems to be a lot of support to make sure that school closures themselves are not going to affect educational funding. Now, of course, larger economic effects might, you know, affect California's long-run budget on education, but that's still not tied to school closures themselves.
So, Dr. Sidhu, I'd like to come back to you. Of course, you know, just yesterday, Governor Newsom gave the statewide stay-at-home order, partially out of concern over hospital capacity, specifically shortage of beds and equipment like ventilators, as well as a potential lack of medical professionals, depending on how quickly the virus or the pandemic rolls out. From what you're seeing, how prepared is the Central Valley to address this crisis?
You know, that's also a great question. You're absolutely correct. There have been lots of reports regarding the lack of masks, particularly the N95 mask for high-risk procedures, as well as ventilators. Fortunately, the Trump administration on Wednesday said that it would invoke the Defense Production Act to increase the production of medical supplies necessary for fighting the coronavirus pandemic, which includes these two items. Now, in terms of the Valley specifically, I'm not aware of the exact number of these supplies, but we appear to be generally well-equipped at this time. But again, this is an evolving picture. Now, with regards to the potential lack of medical professionals, the federal government is working on a new regulation that would allow medical professionals to work across state lines amid the coronavirus outbreak. Now, if this is released, physicians and other medical professionals would no longer need a new state license to care for patients living in another state, and would be able to treat more COVID-19 patients, particularly in these hotspots.
What are emergency rooms doing to prepare for this imminent huge increase in COVID-19 cases?
Yeah, now, although I can't speak for any specific ER, the nation as a whole is coming up with very creative solutions to scale up their capacity to see patients in a safe manner. Some ERs, for instance, are setting up tents in the parking lots to assess patients before they enter the ER. The purpose of this is to prevent infected patients from mixing with the general population and potentially spreading COVID to other uninfected patients. Some hospitals are canceling elective surgeries in the process to free up beds. The good thing is that hospitals are spending time preparing for this increase now, so when the demand does occur, or if it hasn't already occurred, they can provide the patient with the best possible care.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we are live with three experts answering your questions about COVID-19. One of our panelists here with us today is Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Dwan Utek. I'd like to bring the next question to you, Dwan. How do we talk to teens about the importance of social distancing without freaking them out?
Well, you know, teens are one of those groups that really relies on that social connectedness. The good news is they do a lot of that via social media already. So we would encourage them to continue to use social media to communicate and interact. But interaction is so important, so we have to find safe ways to continue interacting. Under the guidelines of the current orders, you still can get together in small groups and practice social distancing with hand washing. So I would recommend that telling them to stick to home settings for those interactions with a small number of set friends is not a bad way to go about it, and that enables them to have their need for social connectedness while at the same time staying safe and keeping others safe around them.
Right, and minimizing the impact of isolation on their emotional worlds, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
Great. So Dr. Sidhu, we'll come back to you. You are an emergency physician with UCSF Fresno. According to new data, speaking of young people, according to new CDC data, almost 40% of the patients that needed to be hospitalized for COVID-19 are between the ages of 20 and 54. What do these findings mean for millennials and Gen Xers, especially because up to just the last week or so, much of the conversation around COVID-19 has been that it's the older population that is most vulnerable?
Yeah, you know, thanks for bringing this up. New data from the CDC are helping us create a picture of the spectrum of the illness caused by COVID-19 in the U.S. Essentially, the findings up to this point echo what has been already documented in China, The risk of serious disease and death is higher in older age groups. But they aren't the only age groups at risk, as you mentioned. It shows that younger adults can be more vulnerable as well to serious illness. That being said, it's important to note that these findings by the CDC are preliminary. There are now nearly 14,000 confirmed cases in the U.S., and as testing ramps up, there'll be a much clearer picture of just how many people of all age groups have been infected. Also remember that at the beginning of any epidemic, or pandemic in this case, the healthcare system is identifying the sickest people, those who go to the hospitals for treatment. And it's likely missing people who have only mild symptoms. So this number may actually be a lot lower in the future. That being said, millennials and Gen Xers are not immune from this, and they need to realize that. And they should still take precautions such as washing their hands, social distancing, and so forth.
So you referenced testing. Where do we stand in the Valley regarding the availability of COVID-19 tests?
Kits to test people for COVID-19 are available in Fresno County, but not everyone meets the criteria right now since we have a limited supply. At present, we want to be testing our high-risk populations who are symptomatic. These populations include the elderly, people who have been outside the country, or to areas with cases of community transmission, such as certain counties of the Bay Area and LA. Now, as more testing becomes available, we can test more people, and that can become more widespread. That being said, if you do have concerns, please reach out to your primary care doctor, and they can help you make that decision about testing for your individual situation.
So I'd like to move the conversation back over to UC Merced economics professor Ketki Sheff. One of the things that has been dominating the headlines this past week has obviously been the stock market and its extreme volatility. What do you have to say to folks about is there any way to predict what's going to happen moving forward, or what could be done to settle the stock market?
You know, one component of the stock market is it's a signal of how people are feeling about the future. And so I think once the uncertainty is reduced and there's a strong sense of, you know, how the disease is progressing, how the government is taking actions to reduce the health and economic fallout, then that'll hopefully improve people's outlooks for the future economic environment. So as we see stronger movements by both the central and local governments to really take the pandemic seriously, you know, all the types of actions we're seeing in the Central Valley itself, and for these economic relief measures to be passed from the central government, then that's really going to help improve people's outlook of the future and hopefully help settle the stock market.
Dwan Utek, you're with the Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about, I'll make it personal. So my husband is a bit of a hypochondriac, and he's been pointing out that this is a particularly bad time to be a hypochondriac. And even myself, I have seasonal allergies. I get a tickle in my throat and I start to get really concerned. What advice do you have for people to just manage their hypochondria in this time?
Well, I think a lot of people have similar feelings now, especially, you know, whether you started out being a hypochondriac or not. I think many people in situations like these worry. And so we really want people to focus on the facts and what you can control. We can all control following the guidelines. It's so important now and in the future that we wash our hands, that we keep our social distance, et cetera. And that's something you can control. Most people who get COVID-19 will be fine and can recover at home. Certainly, as the doctor mentioned, we have high-risk individuals, and there is risk in other age groups and such. But we do know that most people will recover, and that's important for people to remember when they begin to worry. Developing a small number of trusted resources, our Fresno County Department of Behavioral Health is a great resource to look to for facts about it, and really don't overly indulge in the news. There's all kinds of information out there, and if you can develop just a limited number of resources to focus on, that can help you manage that panic or anxiety that might occur.
So, Dr. Sidhu, I'd like to come back to you with another of our listener questions, again from Rebecca in Sanger. She wants to know if she should be wearing gloves or a mask when she goes to the store, grocery store, or is it enough to just wash her hands and not touch her face?
You know, this is a great question. I think it's a question that many people at this time have on their minds. Now, according to the World Health Organization, if you are healthy, you only need to wear a mask if you're taking care of a person with a suspected COVID infection. It should also be used by people who have COVID and are showing symptoms in order to protect others from the risk of getting the infection. It's important to remember that masks are effective only when used in combination with frequent hand cleaning with either an alcohol-based hand rub or soap and water. Now, Rebecca also brought up a very good point, and that's not to touch your face. If you do wear a mask, avoid reaching under it. Trust me, they itch a lot. And don't touch your nose or mouth because the virus can spread by unwashed hands.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today we are live with three experts answering your question about COVID-19 and the way it is impacting all of our lives. Dwan Utek, Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health. This week, a lot of people shifted to working from home. What tips do you have on how to strike a good work-life balance when you are at home and largely isolated from the outside world?
Well, we really recommend that people develop a schedule which includes breaks. I think a lot of people are focused on the work, and we need to make sure that you take breaks. Making time for self-care and certainly attending to the needs of your other family members. But as we stated earlier, really staying connected with others. We all can suffer the effects of social isolation, and there are ways to stay connected without being in the same room. So whether it's a phone call, text, email, or connecting through social media, make sure that you exercise. Make sure that you do activities with your family member. You still can go outside, and that's why it's really important that we take breaks. We know that staying healthy is an important thing to do to avoid any illness, and so the more you can make sure that you're developing that work-life balance of both taking care of the work that needs to get done, but taking breaks.
This is another listener question that we received this week from one of our listeners, Heather Halsey Martinez. She manages the care of her 64-year-old quadriplegic father. She has a team of more than six caregivers that attend to his basic needs. What Heather wants to know is if the size of this team is putting her father at risk of COVID-19. So should she reduce his care team at this time or continue to move forward as normal?
Now, Heather, thank you for reaching out. Taking care of a loved one is hard at baseline. And when you add the stressors of something like COVID into the picture, it can definitely become harder. Now, I don't know the specifics of why your father needs six caregivers, but I would try to limit the number of caregivers to what is essential, because quite simply, the less people your father is in contact with, the less likely he is to get infected. It's also important for the caregivers to wear proper PPE and to take precautions such as thoroughly washing their hands before they work with your father.
Professor Schaff, looking at through my notes, UCLA Anderson Forecast released a report this week that stated that the nation is already in a recession and that California is going to be hit by this recession particularly hard. What is your take on that analysis, and why is California in a position to really be hit by this economic slowdown?
You know, I think one of the reasons that forecast predicted California was going to be hit hard is because we're just very strong in industries that are more exposed to the virus, the consequences of the virus, right? So we already know there's going to be this reduced productivity and lower economic growth. And a lot of that is coming from the fact that we really need to be socially distancing right now. So it's true that California, for example, has a really large hospitality and leisure industry And that's where we would expect that social distancing is really going to have a large economic impact. And we're seeing that come through in that Anderson forecast. You know, but it's also important to remember that California has strengths in industries that are more easily adaptable to working remotely and more resilient to a temporary reduction in demand for services, such as the tech industry. But I think really there's no getting around the fact that COVID-19 is going to reduce our economic output. And so the key question is, how do we ensure the fall in economic growth is as short-lived and as small a magnitude as possible? And, you know, one of the key features of that report that I found really interesting and seems to be reiterated by economists kind of globally now is that the economic effects are a function of the length of the time of the pandemic. And so the quicker the pandemic abates, you know, the less harmful the economic effects will be.
So speaking of ending the pandemic, Dr. Sidhu, we're hearing so much in the news about, quote unquote, flattening the curve. Can you just explain what that means for our listeners?
Now, I believe that out of every major crisis out there, there comes a saying always. So, for instance, after the terrorist attack on 9/11, it was, this changes everything. During World War II, the British said, keep calm and carry on. Great advice both then and now. For the coronavirus pandemic of 2020, it looks like the saying will be flatten the curve. Now, I'm going to try to explain this without any visual aid since this is a radio broadcast, so wish me luck. Now, in epidemiology, the curve refers to the projected number of new cases over a period of time. The goal with flattening the curve is to not have a steep exponential rise in cases of COVID-19, but instead a gradual rise in cases so that there isn't an overburdened healthcare system all at one time. The cases are instead staggered over time so that people can get the best access to healthcare. For example, in the news, we hear about ventilators and how there's a shortage of ventilators. If we could flatten the curve to the point where everyone has access to a ventilator when they need it, as opposed to many people showing up to the hospital at the same time and not having access to ventilators, then flattening of the curve has worked because people have better access to healthcare and more chance of survival. The next question is, that comes along with this, how can the curve be flattened? And the way to do that is simply to cut the spread by doing things like social distancing, shelter-in-place orders, restrictive travel measures, and asking citizens to work or engage in school from home. Basically, all of the things we're currently living through at this time.
So speaking of flattening the curve, Dwan, what is being done to protect people in residential mental health facilities?
The government has issued guidelines on both infection control as well as social distancing and guidance on when an individual shows symptoms of illness, how to isolate them and such. We do know that, again, most people will recover oftentimes in residential facilities, whether they're mental health or otherwise. They might have some underlying health conditions, so it's even more important, all of the things that Dr. Sidhu mentioned that we do in those situations. But we are sharing all of that information widely across the state and the nation with our partners. We certainly are all learning as we go along what works and how to most effectively implement it.
So Dr. Sidhu, I'd like to come back to you one more time. You know, there's an ongoing conversation in the Central Valley about lack of access to quality health care for people in rural communities. Given the situation that we are already in, what are your thoughts or what might we expect to see in terms of the COVID-19 outbreak once it reaches more density in rural communities?
This is a particularly vulnerable population. Rural hospitals now have the unprecedented challenge of handling COVID-19 along with other medical needs of the community in an already strained system. Now, there was a recent Forbes article which said that basically 15% of the American population lives in rural areas. And what makes things more challenging is that the average age is 73, which, as we know, is bad if you have a COVID-19 infection because older age groups have been shown to do worse than younger patients. So one particular challenge and roadblock is getting the word out. through social media, website posts, podcasts, or anything like that, which would be beneficial for a lot of residents in these areas to do things like shelter in place. But it is hard since broadband is still lacking in some of these areas. What healthcare professionals are currently doing is that they're using local newspapers and radio to get the word out about what people can be doing to help prevent an outbreak. Now, in terms of the actual medical response and equipping the rural hospitals in the case of an outbreak, federal and state agencies, along with national organizations, are sharing resources and guidelines to help all communities, including rural communities, respond to this issue.
Professor Sheth, I have another listener question. This one is from Ben. The United States, I'm reading what he wrote, the United States is one of the richest countries in the world, yet we have a large deficit, and most people don't want to pay more taxes. In this context, the government is being called on to spend trillions of dollars to help people affected by the virus. What are the long-term effects of this?
The question is worded really interestingly, that we're spending trillions to help people affected by the virus. But it's important to note that this virus is not only affecting a portion of the population, it's really affecting all of us,
right?
Even if not directly. It's important to recognize that the virus is affecting all of us, even if not directly through our health. The economic impact of the pandemic, both through reduced demand in the short run, but also the aftermath, if we're not able to abate the pandemic quickly or allow businesses and individuals to stay solvent, is going to be incredibly costly. Dr. Sidhu, I thought, did just a really great job right now trying to describe this flattening the curve from the health perspective. And you can actually think of a similar graphic about wanting to flatten the curve for the economic fallout, right? And what's really nice about trying to flatten that curve is it's not that we're just spreading it over time, but we actually have the ability to really reduce the economic impact through taking proactive measures. And so the hope is that the severity of the pandemic on our economy, if we don't have this economic assistance or really active measures, is expected to be significantly greater. And so if we're just doing, this cost-benefit analysis of what is going to be less expensive, I would bet on paying for measures now to reduce the economic fallout in the long run. In general, the long-term prospects of our economic prosperity and growth is much worse in the absence of not taking these strong measures to curb the economic losses in the short run.
So speaking of the spread of the virus, Dr. Sidhu, I have a couple questions for you about how COVID-19 spreads. When somebody contracts the virus, how long are they susceptible of spreading it to others? And then talk also about testing. So once you're symptomatic and then do test, how long does it take to get the results back? I just want to get a sense of what kind of window are we looking at from exposure to COVID-19 to transmission, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah, I think I get the question there. So in terms of exposure, once you're exposed, you can be asymptomatic for what they're describing to be up to 14 days. Now, during that time period, you still can, even though you're not exhibiting any symptoms, transmit this virus to other people, which is one of the reasons why we're having this shelter in place and try to flatten the curve. When people are most symptomatic is when they're actually more likely to transmit this disease. So for instance, they start exhibiting a cough or anything like that. When they cough on someone else, they're more likely to transmit it. Now, in terms of the testing, that is a very varied response. I've heard anywhere from hearing back within 24 hours to 5 days, depending upon the lab that is being utilized. That being said, the good thing is we are working on not me particularly, but as a whole, as a system, we're working on getting the testing down so quick that we'd be able to get it within a few hours. So we can tell someone right away if they have COVID-19.
And then given that we're being told now that the pandemic could last well into the summer, does that mean that the virus is not seasonal?
Okay, so the question is, will the COVID-19 outbreak fade as the Northern Hemisphere warms up? Now, this has been suggested by some researchers and repeated by some political leaders, including our president and UK's health secretary, Matt Hancock, but we simply at this point don't know if it will be the case. As far as COVID-19 being seasonal, like the flu, where it comes back every winter, that too is not known at this particular time.
Well, I want to thank all of you so much for taking the time to be with us, to answer our listeners' questions, and to shed some light on a very uncertain time. So a big thank you to our panelist, UCSF emergency room physician, Dr. Manajit Sidhu, Fresno County Director of Behavioral Health, Dewan UTech, and UC Merced Economics Professor, Kat T. Sheff. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In these unsettled times, it can be very challenging for parents to know how to talk to their children about school closures and the spread of COVID-19. Earlier this week, I spoke with a pediatric psychologist, Dr. Amanda Supli, about what we can do to minimize anxiety for children and for teens. What are your tips for talking to children about school closures?
I think the most important thing to start off with is just to be aware that children have likely been exposed to what's going on, whether it's with friends in at school or in the neighborhood, and also likely have seen stuff on the media. And so to assume they have heard something rather than being afraid to talk about what's going on. At this point, schools have already been closed, so children are aware of a change in their routine. So just talking to children about what they know and what they are worried about. And if you start there, I think you'll get a good picture of what is going on for your child. And then as much as you can, being honest with them in age-appropriate language. A lot of information can be very overwhelming for children, so using knowing how your child takes information in is really important, and using that to guide how much you share with them.
So to that end, when you're talking to a child, how do you suggest conveying the importance of the situation without creating more anxiety or more stress, and maybe speak to the age appropriateness of these conversations? What are your tips?
Absolutely. So I think for parents, it's really important to be mindful of your own anxiety around the situation. This is a really stressful time for everyone, and kids really take their cues from the people around them. Adults model how to cope with things to their children, and that's how they learn. So taking time to calm yourself and be mindful of how you're processing the information to start with. And so if you approach this in a calm manner, you're more likely going to be able to respond to those questions in a different way and be able to model to your children about how to manage anxiety. So I think that's a good place to start. I also think that it's important we're talking about the age-appropriate language. It's really important to be honest. So getting information from trusted resources, but knowing that what a 5-year-old can handle is very different than what, say, a 15-year-old can handle.
So speaking of a 15-year-old, what are your suggestions for managing anxiety around COVID-19 for teens and young adults?
For older children and teenagers and young adults, talking to them about what they're hearing on the news and correcting any misinformation or rumors you may hear, or that they're hearing from peers or from the media, because they're likely exposed to a lot more than we realize and are probably taking a lot more information in. And so it's really important just to have an open conversation about what are the things that you're hearing and how can I help answer those questions for you? And as much as possible, trying to keep them away or limiting time on media, whether it's the news or social media or computers, it's just trying to limit their exposure to some of these things that might be a bit more frightening.
Well, that's a difficult thing to do when kids are home. You know, how do you suggest that parents address boredom? I mean, what tips do you have to keep children stimulated and engaged in situations like this?
Absolutely. I think that's a key piece here is that a lot of children are not used to being home. And so now being home and not being able to leave the house, you're likely going to see a lot more boredom. You're probably going to see a lot more irritability as well, because it's just a huge change in their routine. And so as much as you can structure and have some sort of routine each day will help with children. Children really do, and teenagers too, really crave routine and predictability, especially in times of chaos or uncertainty. It helps them to manage their own emotions around the situation. So as much as possible, having a structure at home, whether it's, okay, right now we're going to do an hour of math, and then we're going to do an hour of reading a book, and then we're going to go and play in our backyard for an hour. As much as possible, trying to schedule those times around your day, regular bedtimes or meal times can be really helpful. Including your children in creating those activities gives them a sense of control in an environment right now that feels very uncontrolled. And so asking them, like, okay, for this hour, would you like to do math or reading? Would you like to play music, or would you like to do yoga together? Would you like to watch a movie or play a game? And I think giving them a sense of control in this situation, actually you'll see a lot more interest in what they do and a lot less irritability. There's also a significant amount of resources online right now for education and other activities during the day. So there are a lot of companies who are providing free resources to children at different age groups and free activities for educational resources as well as leisurely activities. So I think it's important that families are aware of places to go, such as Scholastic has information and resources for education, PBS Kids. There's YouTube videos, Cosmic Kids Yoga, which provides physical activity, which is they're not going to be able to get as much of.
Those great resources. Thank you. You know, sometimes children don't have the language to express what they're feeling. So I'm wondering, what kinds of behaviors should parents be looking for that might indicate that their child is experiencing anxiety? And if you can, address both young children and teens.
Yes, so most children, even into teenage years, do not have the ability to say, I am feeling anxious. We're going to be able to see, parents are going to notice a lot more changes in sleep. So a child who is sleeping less or sleeping more than normal, appetite changes, so a child who's eating more or eating less than normal. And a big key factor is really irritability or changes in behavior. So if you notice a lot more agitation or grumpiness, children who are crying more easily or more withdrawn, those are things that are going to be key pieces. And it's really more about just a change in the child's behavior is something that we want to keep an eye out for.
And then at that point, when you see those changes, the solution is to just be honest, to open lines of communication. What would you recommend?
Yes. So being honest, open lines of communication, increasing time together, social activities. So I know that's really challenging for a lot of parents, and every family is different right now in terms of who can be at home and who cannot. But having special time together of, okay, instead of doing schoolwork or talking about the things that are making us feel scared, we're going to just play a game together. Play is very important for children, so we need to remember that as much structure and activities we have in our day, they also need time to still be kids, and play is built in during school time, so as much as they can get during the day, that'll be helpful. There's other resources online, mental health resources, there's books about how to talk about feelings, there's lots of children's books about just identifying and naming our emotions, things like there's a book called In My Heart or The Way I Feel, and those are really wonderful resources just to open conversations about emotions. And certainly if you are to the point where you are truly concerned about your child and how they are coping with the situation, then you can always reach out to your pediatrician for extra support.
So just to close, can you give parents some talking points? What do you suggest they emphasize during this time?
I think the thing to really emphasize is just provide reassurance to your child and to let them know that even though the schools have closed, it's really because they want to keep their students and staff safe, even if no one at their school has the virus. And to explain to them that the government, schools, doctors, and other adults are doing everything they can to prevent the spread of the virus and to find the treatment. So I think providing reassurance to children is just a scary time. And so any little bit that you can do to remind them that you are going to do everything in your power to keep them safe goes a long way. also validating emotions and let them know, yeah, it is okay to be worried right now. It is okay to be scared when there's something new that we don't know much about. But I'm going to do everything I can to keep you safe. And this is how we're going to do that at home. And then maybe having a discussion with your children about the things you have implemented in your own home about safety. So how do we wash our hands? How do we cough or sneeze into our elbow? How do we not try to touch our face? We don't go outside when we're not feeling well. So things like that that you've already implemented into your own home to give them some sort of like, when I am feeling stressed, I can do these to provide a sense of control.
Well, Dr. Supali, we really appreciate these tips. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Staniel, Carrie Klein, Laura Satsui, and Mari Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2021 James Irvine Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together on the web at chcf.org.